I knew something was wrong before I knew what wrong was. I was 28 the first time I said it out loud, sitting on the exam table in a paper gown, the kind that never covers anything quite right, and the doctor was already writing before I finished the sentence. I had been having pain for almost 2 years at that point. Not constant, not dramatic, but persistent in a way that made me track it. A dull pressure in my lower abdomen that flared before my period and sometimes stayed after. Fatigue that didn't map onto my sleep schedule. Bloating that came in waves with no food trigger I could identify. I had brought a list. 3 months of notes on a sheet of paper I'd folded into my coat pocket because I'd read somewhere that doctors respond better to organized patients. He glanced at it. He told me it sounded like irritable bowel syndrome, gave me a pamphlet on dietary changes, and said to come back if it got worse. I believed him. He was the doctor. I was a 28-year-old woman, describing pain that didn't have a clean, visible cause. And the pamphlet had a phone number at the bottom, and that felt like something. The second doctor was 18 months later. Different practice, same city. I'd changed my diet, the way the pamphlet suggested. Nothing had changed. The pain was more frequent now. I'd started mapping it more carefully, noting when it spiked relative to my cycle, when it woke me up at night, when it made it hard to sit through a full workday. I brought a more detailed log this time. I said I was concerned this wasn't dietary. She reviewed my notes. She ordered blood work. The CBC came back within normal range. She told me that sometimes women in their late 20s experience cyclical pelvic discomfort due to hormonal fluctuation, that it often resolved on its own, and that I should consider stress management as a contributing factor. She asked about my work situation, my relationship, whether I was sleeping enough. I drove home and sat in my car in the parking lot for 20 minutes. Not crying, just quiet, trying to figure out if she was right and I was making too much of something ordinary, or if I was right and she wasn't listening. I hadn't told her about the night last October when the pain had been bad enough that I'd sat on my bathroom floor with my back against the cold tile because it helped. I hadn't mentioned that because it had sounded, even to me, like something dramatic and fleeting. There is a particular kind of doubt that medical dismissal plants in a woman. It doesn't announce itself. It grows in the space between what you feel and what you've been told to feel. It makes you a less reliable narrator of your own body. The third doctor was the one who used the word anxious. I was 31. I had seen a gynecologist the previous year who had done a pelvic exam, found nothing abnormal on physical examination, and referred me back to my GP with a note that said the examination was unremarkable. I'd asked about endometriosis. She'd said it was possible, but that diagnosis required laparoscopy, and she didn't think my symptoms warranted that level of intervention yet. The third doctor, my new GP after I'd moved for work, was thoughtful and patient and asked good questions. He also, at the end of the appointment, after I'd described everything, said, "Some of what you're describing does sound like it could have an anxiety component. I want to refer you to someone who can help with that piece, alongside looking at the physical." I went to the referral. I did the work. My anxiety improved. My pain didn't. By 33, I had stopped going to the doctor about it, not because the pain had stopped, because I had run out of the particular energy it takes to describe something that nobody validates. There is a calculus that happens, maybe so gradually you don't notice it. The emotional cost of being disbelieved, weighed against the practical cost of another appointment that changes nothing, against the creeping certainty that you are simply someone whose pain doesn't register in the way that prompts action. I want to be honest about that period. I was not a passive patient. I was not someone who didn't speak up. I kept records. I researched. I asked about endometriosis by name, twice. I asked about ovarian cysts. I was told more than once in words and in the subtext of how quickly people moved on, that the answer was probably lifestyle, probably stress, probably hormonal, probably something I could manage better on my own. The year I was 35, I noticed that the bloating had changed. It wasn't waves anymore. It was more consistent. My abdomen felt different. Not dramatic, not a visible change I could point to, but a pressure that didn't leave the way it used to. I had also, in the last 2 months, lost 9 pounds without changing anything. I mentioned this to a colleague who had had ovarian cancer in her 40s. She told me to go back to the doctor. She told me to use the words, "I'm concerned about something serious." I did. I used those words. The doctor I saw, a woman in her 50s, someone I'd been told was very good, ordered a pelvic ultrasound. The ultrasound showed a mass on my left ovary. She referred me to a gynecologic oncologist. The biopsy came back 12 days later. High-grade serous ovarian carcinoma, stage 3. The cancer had spread to lymph nodes in my abdomen. I sat with that piece of paper and thought about the note I had brought to the first appointment, the one I'd folded into my coat pocket, at 28. The median survival rate for stage 3 ovarian cancer diagnosed in women under 40, as of the data available when I was sitting in that oncologist's office, is approximately 44% at 5 years. For stage 1, contained to the ovary, it is over 90%. The difference between those numbers is the interval between when the disease was present and when it was found. Ovarian cancer is often silent in its early stages, but it is not always silent. Sometimes it speaks in the language of persistent pelvic pain and bloating that doesn't behave like bloating, and fatigue that doesn't match your sleep, and a weight loss you didn't seek. Sometimes it speaks for years before anyone writes down what it said. Endometriosis, which affects 1 in 10 women of reproductive age, is on average diagnosed 7 to 10 years after symptoms begin. Not because it is rare, not because it is difficult to identify once investigated properly, because a pattern of attributing cyclical pelvic pain in women to lifestyle factors, stress, or normal hormonal fluctuation has made the first step, taking the pain seriously, consistently the hardest one to get to. I want to be careful here. I am not claiming that every doctor I saw was negligent by the standard they were operating under. I am saying that the standard they were operating under was shaped by decades of research conducted predominantly on male bodies, published in literature that treated unexplained pain in women as a psychosomatic presentation until proven otherwise, evaluated by a culture in which women, especially young women, especially women who do not present dramatically, are systematically less likely to receive timely workup for conditions that cause pain without obvious visible markers. A 2019 study published in the Journal of Pain found that women experiencing pain were more likely to be prescribed anxiety medication and less likely to be prescribed pain medication than men reporting equivalent pain levels. A 2021 analysis in JAMA Internal Medicine found that women with cardiovascular symptoms were more likely to receive a mental health diagnosis and less likely to receive cardiac workup than men presenting with the same symptom profile. These are not fringe findings. These are peer-reviewed observations from within the medical literature about patterns in how women's reported symptoms are processed. I went through 6 rounds of chemotherapy. I had cytoreductive surgery. I lost my left ovary and fallopian tube, and a section of peritoneum and a margin of bowel. I lost 8 months of my life to treatment and its aftermath. I lost, in the most permanent way possible, the possibility of having children, which I had been quietly holding in reserve for later, the way you do when you're 33, and focused on work and not yet ready, but also not yet willing to say never. The cancer is in remission. I do not take that word lightly or assume it is permanent. I think about the woman at 28 with the folded piece of paper. I think about the note she made in October about the bathroom floor. I think about the 2 years between that appointment and the next one, and the 3 years after that when I stopped going, and the total distance between the first symptom and the diagnosis, which was 7 years. 7 years is a long time for a disease to have a head start. The particular shame of this, if you want to call it shame, and I do because it is the right word, is that I spent 7 years wondering whether I was making too much of it. The doctors I saw didn't tell me I was making too much of it with those exact words. They told me with referrals to pamphlets and suggestions about stress and the clinical efficiency with which they moved to the next item. The medical system didn't fail me loudly. It failed me in increments. In the quiet administrative logic of a standard of care, that had not yet accounted for the specific ways women's pain gets translated into something manageable and ordinary before it is investigated. I am not a cautionary tale. I am a person who is still here and grateful for it, and angry in the specific way that comes from knowing how clearly something could have gone differently. What I want, the only thing I want that feels like it matters, is for the woman who is sitting in an exam room right now, describing pain that has been described and dismissed before, to be told, "We're going to look at this carefully," not, "Here is a pamphlet," not, "This might have an anxiety component," just, "We're going to look." The question I can't stop coming back to, 7 years and a stage 3 diagnosis later, at what point in that timeline was the outcome still changeable? And who owns the answer to that question?